The science and ethics of editing humans' DNA went on high alert in November of 2018 when it was revealed that two babies had been born after their embryos had been CRISPRed. Professor Henry T. Greeley, the director of the Stanford Center for Law and the Biosciences, was notified, and within minutes of the news, Greeley was drawn into an ethical debate that we all must consider. Greeley asks and attempts to answer in his book the question, is it ethical to mess with human embryos? His book, CRISPR People, in which Greeley says things are about to get interesting. This is an experiment that feels like a cross between bad fiction and reckless fiasco, shrouded in a deep fog of secrets. The experiment in question took place in China by scientist He Zhongqi, who attempted to edit the CCR5, a gene known to be important in allowing HIV to infect some human cells. Greeley says the goal of the experiment was to make the gene inoperative and thus deprive HIV of the gateway for infection. The two edited embryos of the non-identical twin sisters were transferred into their mother's uterus sometime in late March or early April of 2018, and then sometime in October, somewhere in China, they were born. Now, on the surface, this is a noble idea. The reality of the experiment, however, is nothing short of an attempt to win the Nobel Prize. He, the scientist, forged documents giving him permission to conduct the experiment, and he is now in prison in China. And his imprisonment has frustrated many who want to know more about his experiment, which appears to have been an exercise in his own aggrandizement. I invited Henry Greeley to join me for a conversation that matters about human germline editing. Professor Greeley, thank you for joining me on Conversation That Matters. This, in your book, you said things are about to get interesting. How so? Like, what it makes this so interesting from your perspective, especially from an ethical point of view?
Sure. What's so interesting is our ability now to change our DNA in ways that will potentially outlive ourselves. So there's been a lot of attention paid over the last 30 years, finally crowned with some success for gene therapy, treating genetic diseases by changing the DNA of people with those diseases. But if it's a disease like sickle cell anemia, that affects the bone marrow cells. If it's cystic fibrosis, it affects the lung cells. You change those cells. If you're lucky, if things go well, the patient gets healthy, lives his life, he or she dies, and the changes die with them. If, on the other hand, you change sperm or eggs, those changes can live on into subsequent generations. And what He did was change the cells in very early embryos, such that he hoped, not entirely successfully, every cell in the embryo would get changed. Well, if every cell in the embryo gets changed, that means all the cells that make up the brain, that make up the liver, that make up the kidney, or in the case of these two little girls, that make the ovaries and hence the eggs, get changed. And so really, for the first time, we have somebody intentionally changing human DNA, editing human DNA in a way that can pass down to future generations. That, on its face, is a pretty big deal.
Yes, it is. In some ways, we're playing God, aren't we, if we're going to go to that level? And is that really what's at issue here? Are we overstepping the line in our ability or even our right to be able to try and dictate what the future of the human experience is going to be?
So that, of course, will depend on who you ask. If the answer is yes, no, and maybe. My own view is more on the no side. We, quote, play God, close quote, pretty much all the time. You know, God did not provide for you and me to be talking over the internet in this way or for your viewers to see us. I'm going to get on an airplane at some point, and I don't have wings. I'm going to fly without wings. But more to the point, our human DNA actually changes every generation slightly, because of mutations, of changes in the DNA in the eggs and the sperm that accumulate during our lifetimes. So the DNA I have from my father isn't exactly the same as the DNA he got from his father And the DNA my daughter and son got from me isn't exactly the same as what I got from my parents. Not only do we change from time to time, but human affairs, human civilization affects those changes. So, for example, you and I, and probably everybody watching this, has multiple copies of a gene that helps us digest starch. If you go back 40 or 50,000 years, there weren't multiple copies. There was one copy. And then humans invented agriculture, and they started eating starch. My Irish relatives didn't get to potatoes until about the 17th century, but we ate a lot of potatoes. And if you had more genes, more copies of the gene that helped you digest starch, you were healthier. Your kids who inherited that gene were healthier, et cetera. More to the point, with medicine today, so for example, type 1 diabetes, the so-called juvenile onset diabetes, used to be completely deadly. It's not a completely genetic disease, but there are genetic variations that increase your risk of it by about 100-fold, from very low to about 10%. Those variations are more common now because some of those, you know, always conniving Canadians about 100 years ago discovered insulin and figured out how to keep people with type 1 diabetes alive. It was called juvenile onset diabetes. They never had kids because they died earlier. Now they don't. My first cousin is a juvenile onset diabetic with 13, he thinks, grandchildren. That wouldn't have happened but for humans playing God. So we play God all the time. What really interests me in a way is what we've done in the past has been inadvertent. It's been a byproduct of something else. We didn't think about we're going to do agriculture so we can change human genes. It just happened. We seem more concerned about things that we're doing on purpose when we kind of know what's happening than the stuff that just follows in our ignorance from our normal course of events.
Okay, so what is the ethical conundrum then? Because if everything that we're doing is changing our genetic makeup, and as you point out, that is then passed on to the next generation, and we're doing it in some ways unwittingly, why is there an issue about us saying, no, we're going to go into the lab and at the embryonic or sperm level, we're going to now try and alter the course of the history of those human beings?
So I think there are three answers to that. One would be from people who just don't think we should do it intentionally. If it happens as a side effect of something else we're doing, that's one thing. If we go in with our eyes open and say, we're going to change humanity this way, some people would say that's presumptuous, that's going too far. The other problem, of course, is some people might want to change humans in bad ways, in ways that the rest of us don't approve of, in ways that make the world less equal and create strife. At the science fiction extreme, you get to speciation events where humans split into different species. And some are tall and thin and smart, and some are short and not so thin and smart, and you know they're different from each other in ways that could be problematic. And then there's the sort of third problem. One of the really interesting things about playing around with genetics, I've worked on law and genetics and ethics and genetics for about 30 years, is how much we've learned and how much we've learned about what we don't know. So it turns out that there are around, depending on how you define gene, and even that's contentious, there are about 23,000 genes in humans. We have a pretty good idea of some of the things that maybe 1,000 of them do. The other 22,000, we know that when they're broken, they cause diseases. So, for example, there's a terrible genetic disease called Huntington's disease. It's caused when that gene is broken, and it's inevitably deadly, and it's a terrible, long, lingering death. We've known this gene since 1989. We don't know what it's doing normally. We still don't know what it's doing normally. So you have to worry if we do something and we think we know what we're doing, well, maybe we're wrong. That doesn't necessarily mean we shouldn't do it, but it certainly means we need to be careful. And frankly, my biggest objection to Hu Jonquei isn't as much what he did, although I think what he did was wrong, but it was the completely reckless and criminal way in which he did it.
Yes, because he stepped outside of the law in China, let alone sort of what have been the known standards globally within the scientific community. He did everything that he shouldn't have done because he was trying to, it appears, raise his profile as a credible scientist, and in doing so, undermined his own credibility. But it still raises the question, how do we then go about setting, I guess, those standards by which we feel comfortable moving forward as we move into the germline human genome editing?
We make sure it's safe. We don't use an untried, unsafe, unproven process to bring babies into the world. Even the tried and true process that we've used for millennia to bring babies into the world has problems several percent of the time, more than that in countries without good health care. If this caused serious disabilities and 10% of the babies made this way, that's unacceptable. And we just don't know. We don't know whether it's safe. Everyone, I think, except her, agrees shouldn't do it until we know it's safe. So that's the first. If we know it's safe, should we do it at all? And that if is probably at least 10 years in the future. But assuming good safety experiments show that it is reasonably safe, should we do it at all, and if so, for what? Some people say you shouldn't do it at all for some of the earlier plain God and hubris reasons. Other people say, well, you should do it to avoid really, really bad serious diseases. The other problem with any new technology in medicine is it tends to be really expensive and only available to the consumers and the patients in the very best circumstances. And that's a justice problem, which is an ethics problem as well. So serious disease, and then you solve it not only for that patient, for the embryo that becomes the baby that becomes the parent, but for their children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. That's probably the most attractive use. Then you get possible uses like what He tried to do, give people a safety valve, a protection against HIV. And the other side of it is you're changing a type of sequence of the gene that 99.9% of us have to one that 0.1% of us have. We know the 99.9 is pretty safe because we've all got it. I mean, it's not safe against HIV, but it's safe against other things. The other one, there is some early evidence that it may increase your risk of dying from West Nile virus or from influenza. And then the one that everybody worries about is enhancement, is, you know, changing genes so that parents can get kids who are 6'8" with violet eyes and wonderful volleyball players who have perfect pitch and always say yes, sir, and yes, ma'am, and always are respectful to their parents and all those other good things. Or in some countries are always loyal to the dear leader, you know, whatever it is.
Okay, so here's the hard rub, though. You say, don't do it until we know it's safe. But how do we know if it's safe if we don't do it?
Yes, and yes, and all this is true, and yet you can never get assurance. You can get closer to confidence, you can get confidence, you can get closer to certainty or far away from certainty. He had never even done this in monkeys. He had no, or seen how embryos develop. He had no idea what was going to happen. You could do this in monkeys. Do it in 1,000 monkeys and see how many of them were born normally, were born successfully, were healthy, etc. You could take human embryos and take 1,000 embryos and watch them for 14 days and see whether they were developing normally or not. You can do a bunch of things to make it seem safer, but you're absolutely right. In every kind of drug trial or medical intervention, there comes a moment when you've got to roll the dice. You know, the cards aren't worth anything if you never lay them down. And anybody doing first-in-human trials needs to call on whatever good luck charms, prayers, superstitions, salt over the shoulder, anything else they've got. Because we have cases. Every few years, people die in phase one trials for things that look safe in other animals, but turn out to be a problem for humans. So we can't be sure, but we can be really, really unsure, recklessly, criminally unsure, or we can be reasonably confident.
Right.
And I think those of us, most people in the field are eager to go for reasonably confident.
Right. And so I can understand why it's better that we stay at that somatic cell level of gene intervention, because whatever is done for that individual ends with that individual. And that gives us a better sense of the fact that we're not altering the course of a whole family's line of history, but rather the history of that one individual.
Right, although, of course, by letting that one individual live longer, you're allowing him or her to have a family that he or she wouldn't have, and that family may turn out to include, you know, Adolf Hitler, or it may turn out to include George Washington or Abraham Lincoln.
Right.
So you can never avoid uncertainty entirely. But I think it's even more complicated, a little more complicated than you laid out. It's not just that if you make the germline mutation, it can affect subsequent generations. If you mutate, if you change, if you edit an embryo, in those first 9 months of development in the uterus, what's the change doing?
Right.
We don't know. And we do know that most genes do, we don't know what they do, but we know they do several different things. So if you're doing it in an adult with sickle cell disease and changing the cells that make red blood cells, you can be more confident about what you aren't doing than if you make the change in an early embryo. Maybe it would make no difference, but you don't really know. So I think there are prudential reasons to stick with somatic cell. And one of the things I say in the book, I don't think people are going to want to use this very much, because most of what you want to do, you could do through somatic cell gene editing. So don't fix the embryo, wait till the baby's born and fix it. Now, right now we can only do that for two or three diseases, but 5 years ago it was zero diseases. And 5 years from now it'll be 15 diseases and then 50 diseases. Or there's a procedure that's safe and effective and been in clinical use for more than 30 years called preimplantation genetic diagnosis, where you make embryos, you have to use IVF, which is a pain and expensive, but you make embryos and then you do genetic tests on the embryos. And rather than try to change the embryo that has the Huntington's disease version so it doesn't have that version, on average, half the embryos will have it and half the embryos won't. You just pick the embryos that don't have it. So there are ways to reach a similar result that don't involve changing the embryos, editing the embryos. And at least while there's still a fair amount of uncertainty, I think those are much more attractive possibilities.
Right, because that does take the ethical question of editing that embryo out of the mix, doesn't it? It says, no, we're going to allow the natural process to unfold the way that it would have between those two parents. However, we're going to remove the possibility of Huntington's disease appearing in the embryo that comes to fruition.
Right. There's still a couple of problems with that. Sometimes a couple can only make a small number of embryos. And just by chance, maybe they'll all turn out to be embryos with the disease. Or, and this is the one that actually I'm most sympathetic toward. So take a disease like sickle cell anemia or cystic fibrosis. They're bad diseases. They're what we call autosomal recessive diseases. So you get one bad copy of the gene from each parent. You've got two bad copies of the gene, you don't make the protein, and you get sick. Now people are living longer and healthier lives with this. CF is now life expectancy in the 40s, and it used to be about 8. What if two CF people meet, fall in love, and want to have babies? And they want to have babies that don't have CF. Right now, that couldn't happen because the only versions of the gene they have to give their babies are the bad versions. So if they said, you know, we just want to have healthy babies like anybody else, we need to use gene editing, I'd be sympathetic to that. On the other hand, maybe we'll fix CF through somatic cell editing and make it go away that way. But, you know, I think there will be a few cases that are where it's hard to say, we'll let other people do all sorts of things to try to have healthy babies, but we're not going to let you.
Right. So as we move forward, and you look over the horizon in this field, because as you say, we're still at a very early stage, are you confident that we can figure out how to move forward carefully to ensure that we I don't know necessarily say get it right, but do as little damage or do as little harm as possible.
Yeah, so confident may be a little strong, but I predict that we will do what we humans do often. We will muddle through. We will not hit upon the best possible outcomes and the best possible processes, but we will avoid the worst ones, which is generally what we've managed to do for most things, global warming being perhaps an exception. I think we will avoid the worst aspects of it. That doesn't mean that there might not be additional renegades or cowboys or rogues like Hu Jonquan. Really hard to prevent that from happening. It's not easy because I hate the fact that his name is spelled H-E. It made writing very difficult. He had his own sources of independent money. He didn't have to ask for grants to do this or that. And that's unusual in science. But there will be probably some rogues, and there will be some mistakes, and there will be some harmed babies. But I think we can avoid catastrophe. And frankly, as I've gotten older, my ambitions have declined from trying to maximize the benefits and minimize the harms to trying to help avoid a few catastrophes. I think that's a manageable goal, and that's what I aspire to.
Well, and as you pointed out, that has been the human experience. I think that we do muddle our way through with the objective of continual improvement as we discover new elements of life. And I'm hopeful that we can do this in a way that is responsible, ethical, and will do as little harm as possible, and then provide the benefits that I think we'd all like to see.
Yeah, I think it's really hard to argue with avoiding human suffering. That's a benefit we can all relate to. Yes. And if that's your goal, and this is the good way to do it, it's easy to get behind that. I do think, by the way, that the area where this technology is going to be most important isn't going to be humans. We want to think it's humans because we're humans and we think humans are the most important thing in the world. It's going to be the rest of the organisms of the world because we're not going to be as careful with them. If 10% of mosquito babies end up disabled, people will say, why only 10%? And so CRISPR can work with any kind of organism, and we're beginning to use it on a lot of things. We will use it on a lot of things. And it's not getting as much attention as it should. But that'll be a subsequent conversation that matters, I hope.
Yes, I do too. Thank you very much for taking the time to have this conversation with me. I really appreciate you joining me.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
Okay. Good. That was really good. Thank you.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
yeah.
I enjoyed it.
And I'll send you
really
the link.
I really should have combed my hair, but...
You look great. I'll send you the link when I publish